welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Lauren Meltzer. Our topic for tonight is the increasing impact of Bay Area young philanthropists. The Chronicle of Philanthropy recently released the top five donors of 2012. Three of the five were under 40, and two of them live in the Bay Area. In January, the consulting firm 2164 and the Johnson Center for Family Philanthropy released the results of a landmark survey of young donors. Tonight, we will discuss the results of the survey and try to understand what makes these young donors different. How does their age impact their approach to giving? How are charitable organizations adjusting? And the Bay Area has lost some major philanthropists in the last 5 years. Will this new guard fill their shoes? Joining me to answer these questions and more are in studio Lee Stillwell, the Chief Donor Experience and Engagement Officer at the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. Welcome, Lee.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Stephanie Firstner Gillis, the Senior Director of Foundation Management at Arabella Advisors, philanthropic advisors with offices in San Francisco. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
And joining us by phone is Danielle Orischen York, the director at 2164, which recently collaborated with the Johnson Foundation for Family Philanthropy on a study of young donors called Next Gen Donors. Thank you for joining us, Danielle.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having the conversation.
Great. Well, we will also welcome Jamie Mayer Finney, a young philanthropist who sits on the board of her family foundation, whose money came from the Sara Lee Corporation. And we will be bringing her into the conversation in the middle of our show. And in about 20 minutes, we want to invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. So before we dive into the results of the report, I'd like to start by reviewing what defines philanthropy and how it's the same or different from the giving that many people do, you know, to help nonprofits or causes they believe in. Is there a magic number one has to give to become a philanthropist? Stephanie, you've been working in philanthropy for over 10 years. Can you give us some insight?
Sure. People in historically distinguished between charity and philanthropy. Philanthropy really is, to some extent, when people start getting serious about the work, and it's less about distributing widely and really thinking about the impact of the giving and problem solving to some extent, or getting deeper in it. That would be my answer, my approach, but I welcome others input as well.
Do you have anything to add to that, Lee?
Well, I would say that we recently lowered our minimum to open a donor advised fund at the Community Foundation from $10,000 to $5,000 because we really believe that big ideas and good ideas can come from any place.
Okay. Well, historically, what was the role of, you know, the philanthropist in society, Stephanie?
Sure. The role of philanthropy has gone through a lot of evolutions. I think originally when it was conceived here in the United States, it kind of almost had a Calvinist influence. The Arabella, our name story actually comes from the ship, the Arabella, and John Winthrop's City on a Hill vision for philanthropy, which is that, you know, we need to abridge ourselves of our superfluities on behalf of citizens, and this concept of wanting to do well, do good for others. And so I think in the United States, there's kind of a democratic influence on philanthropy, too. It's a way to help those around you and those with less resources and complement government. I think when you look at it institutionally, philanthropy has been a vehicle for innovations, identifying solutions that then can be taken to scale in the public sector. That may be evolving and changing a little bit in recent years as the sectors become less clearly divided, but that's been the historic role. A lot of opportunities to uncover new solutions or ways to think differently and innovate that can have benefits for society.
And what was the motivation earlier? I mean, was it legacy, visibility, tax write-off, true interest in helping society?
I think legacy and the interest have always been a big part of the motivation. The tax incentive was introduced fairly later on. My colleague Lucy Bernholtz was actually a historian. She knows much more about this. But I think, you know, the original motivators were really about legacy and a sense that when you have this amount of wealth that you've earned in this country in this way, when you look at the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the things that they said about their giving, it was really about the responsibility of being a citizen and giving back.
And these people generally give back at the end of their life, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Historically.
Historically, yeah. So now there's this new wave of philanthropists coming into the picture, the young philanthropist. Danielle, maybe this is a good time to bring you into the conversation. Your company, 2164, recently collaborated with the Johnson Foundation for Family Philanthropy on this study called Next Gen Donors. Why did you decide to do the study?
You know, we have worked with families and family foundations and folks interested in operating in a multi-generational way, kind of engaging this younger generation that you're talking about for 10 years. And one of our motivations was to really concretize the experience we've had over 10 years of working with the younger generation and with the families, the other generations at the table, and bring some data and rigor to it. So that was our mission, but the goal of the research is really to, we endeavored upon a conversation. You know, there's a hashtag that we use in our branding before Next Gen Donors because we want to indicate that this is an important conversation. These young philanthropists are likely to be have begun to be the recipients of about $40 trillion of assets that will pass to them over the next 15 years or so. So this is an important conversation, not just because we're interested in who they are and what they're interested in, but because there are complex challenges ahead of us. And to understand who these leaders are and how they might guide us through solving some of these challenges is important for all of us.
So who did you focus on? You mentioned this $40 trillion. Who are these people?
So we really looked at high capacity donors. So these are people who are giving high capacities today. So some of the donors that you talked about, you know, 3 of 5 in the Chronicle's top 50 philanthropists, they would have been a part of this cohort demographic. So these are 21 to 40 year olds who are actively giving significant philanthropic resources.
Can you tell us a number to give just some sense?
There's a little bit of spread in the way that we measure this. So they range from giving $250,000 a year to being endowed with more than $100 million in this study. So and they're between the ages of 21 and 40 years old. And this is a study just in the United States. So this isn't a global study.
Okay. So what were I guess, the most significant findings?
You know, as I look at this research, I think there are 4 primary findings. One of the things that's particularly striking about this research is that there isn't anything here that is really disruptive or shocking. It's, of course, it's different. And at the same time, it validates, I think, what the experience we have going on already is. From a findings perspective, we found that this is a cohort of young people that are really mostly motivated by values in their principles, not by what they have or what it looks like. They are deeply passionate about impact. It's the word you used when you opened the show today. They're interested and will use any way they can to realize the impact of their giving. They're interested in double and triple line bottom line businesses. They're borrowing ideas and concepts from all different entrepreneurial ventures to, in bringing them to philanthropy, sharpening the point on their work. They're also really interested in bringing and leveraging their networks. I heard a lovely story last week from a young donor who was talking about feeling as though they have much more to give than just their money, that they have their brand, their friends, people that they know. There is a deep sense of what I have to give and how I can bring a network of others into this cause. And the last one, which I think is one of the very most very powerful, is this idea of engagement. These are young people that are really interested in touching and seeing and feeling the work that they're passionate about. They want to, they're interested in new ways of learning. Their identities are still forming. You know, they're still in that kind of young adulthood. And in that way, this idea of community and peer learning is very important. And bringing their whole selves to their work, not just their philanthropist self or their business self or their personal self. They bring all that they have in everything that they do.
Did you talk to people that brought, that made their own wealth, or was it just people that inherited money?
We did. So there are wealth creators in this study, and there also are a significant number of people who have a philanthropic family identity. So people who come from philanthropic families, but there are wealth creators here. So first generation wealth creators.
And did you see much difference in terms of their approach to giving?
You know, there's a bit of a difference in terms of how they cite or who they cite they learned about philanthropy from, which is very logical. If you grew up in a family that has always been passionate about philanthropy, it's part of your family tradition and vernacular. So citing parents and grandparents as primary learning sources makes perfect sense there. Beyond that, in terms of causes or in terms of values or in terms of passion for impact, not so much.
Interesting. Stephanie, do you want to add?
I was just going to say that it's an interesting construct in the wealth advisory community. Our friends at Relative Solutions talk about natives versus immigrants to wealth, and the acquirers are the immigrants, and kind of their relationship to their wealth is somewhat different. And it does, I mean, I think there is other research that shows there are some distinguishers in you can imagine entrepreneurs, especially here in our Bay Area, who have ventured out and done some really, you know, amazing change making within their business lives, maybe a little bit less risk averse in their philanthropy, for example, whereas those who are natives and are inheriting a family philanthropy, at least in, you know, this is not somewhat anecdotal and somewhat based on the research, tend to really take on a stewardship role, are really deep and conscientious. I've been so impressed with a lot of the next gen members who are transitioning into those responsibilities with how thoughtful they are, how committed they are to making sure that those dollars actually are effective. And almost more so than perhaps the prior generations, because they feel like this, they are stewards of these assets.
Let me bring Lee in for a second. So Lee, you're the Chief Donor Experience and Engagement Officer at the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. Tell us a little more about your foundation and how young donors are using it, because this is a new idea, isn't it? It's a different concept in terms of how you use your wealth than the older generations.
Sure. So we manage $2.9 billion in assets. We work with about 2,500 different clients, individuals, families, corporations. And the work that we do really is to make sure that our clients' view of the world, how they think about problem solving, how they think about the most issues that are critical to them, how they really bring that and align that with their philanthropy. So it's not just a question of to whom should I give, but why? What are your values? Let's talk about those. Let's talk about the different lenses that you might put on your philanthropy. So are you an upstream thinker? Do you tend to focus on systems? Do you have more of a sort of a personal approach to your giving? And then with all that data, then we can bring that in and help them define a strategy for their giving that really does align quite beautifully with what they naturally bring to the world, the way they see the world.
What are some of the themes? I mean, I'm assuming that you see probably, you know, even though you have 2,500 people, you probably see certain themes that these days. What are those?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most fun aspects of the work is seeing that sort of the younger donors that are coming into this work, the level of thoughtfulness that they bring to it, as Stephanie said, they really have a wonderful, intense intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. They are not at all afraid of failure. And in fact, I think have learned through their personal experience that failure is part of the learning process. And that so that, that then translates to meetings with nonprofits, right? They want to hear from the development director and the nonprofit ED that they have failed and what they've learned from those failures along the way. Having sort of a perfect track record is actually a red flag. And we think that that's terrific. They recognize that, that, as I said earlier, that the great ideas can come from anywhere and that the answers are there for the discovery. So there's this wonderful, deep-seated sense of possibility and optimism that really helps to sustain them, because no matter if the issue is working on the environment or education reform, inevitably these issues become frustrating, right? Because there are institutional challenges, there are regulatory challenges, and it's that possibility and that knowing that there is an answer just over the horizon that really sustains them through these issues.
So do they, so will they come to you and they'll say, I'm really interested in the environment, and then you'll help narrow in specifically where they should be investing? Mm-hmm.
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
And then do you, so are people these days, are these young donors these days mostly interested in environmental things, or is it kind of across the board?
It's across the board. It's across the board.
If I could, Danielle, yes.
You know, I think one of the things that's interesting about this research is looking at how this group of young philanthropists, what is divergent about their giving. Mm-hmm. You know, they're really much more focused than previous generations in a couple of different areas. Where they're similar is around youth and family, education, and basic needs. Mm-hmm. What's different about them is a real focus in engaging in causes around animal welfare, the environment that you mentioned, civil rights, and advocacy. So I think in so many ways this illustrates this idea of a level of engagement and impact, you know, touching and feeling what it is that they're doing, and having a deep sense of personal alignment from a values perspective and the causes they get passionate about.
And a good example of how that kind of plays out in a family.
We had
a family who had a family foundation that for a long time had been focused on environmental issues and cared deeply about sustainability and other things. And the next gen, when they came on board, was actually going to the systems change. So instead of just necessarily supporting a land trust, they were actually supporting farm-to-table initiatives and policy change and systems work. And I do see that emerging as a trend that they are really eager to tackle upstream.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the latest in the rising impact of young philanthropists. And joining me are Lee Stillwell, the Chief Donor Experience and Engagement Officer at the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, Stephanie Furstner-Gillis, the Senior Director of the Foundation Management at Arabella Advisors, and Danielle Orischin-York, Director at 2164. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What do you think these young philanthropists should be funding? Do you agree that values versus valuables is the way to go? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So when we think of the philanthropists from 10 years ago, the big names that come to mind were Bill Gates, the Haas family, Donald Fisher, Evelyn Haas, Walter Shorstein, Richard Goldman. A except for Bill, all of them have died in the last few years. But who are the bigger young names of today? Lee?
Well, I certainly everyone who follows the newspaper sees the names in the paper. We actually don't disclose any of our clients.
Sure.
Because of our confidentiality. But I will say that I was recently rereading the book that the Goldman Foundation put out when the fund closed last year, and it was the story of Richard and Rhoda and their lives. And there were so many parts of their story that I see in these new young philanthropists in terms of a clarity of vision, a real ability to define a future that they want to see, an ability to, you know, synthesize information from seemingly disparate places. And it was so nice to think about that cycle continuing with these new donors that are coming in, starting early in life, and they're putting their heads and their hearts in the game.
So for those people that aren't reading the news as much as you guys are, I don't know, maybe Stephanie, can you kind of call out some names of people that...
Well, I mean, I think we know here in the Bay Area we've had a tech boom, and I think today's... the philanthropists in their 30s and 40s that are giving today that were influenced, but the Google millionaires and the, you know, people influenced by Facebook and having these opportunities through their entrepreneurship and their participation in these companies, you know, have a huge benefit in that there was this wave of predecessors in the dot-com boom, and it wasn't that long ago. I mean, historically, it feels long to some of us, but, you know, there was a lot of research and thought and writing and thinking, and people learned a lot about how to do things differently with that first wave. So when you look at the Omidyar Foundation and you look at Jeff Skoll's enterprises and you look at some of the examples that emerged out of that first wave, I think it's exciting because those from Google and Mark Zuckerberg and others have these great role models that took on this kind of venture philanthropy approach to look to.
Well, I guess I'm asking because, you know, when we think about the donors, the philanthropists, they basically kind of sign, you know, their names because they gave us different, you know, things that have their names on them, you know, whereas, you know, right now I'm curious, you know, are the philanthropists of today, are there a lot of kind of unsung heroes? Or are there people that, you know, are they the people you would expect?
This is Danielle. I think one of the things that I think is particularly curious about this conversation, why I love that you're hosting it in the Bay Area, is because that is an area that developed this technology that has allowed this generation to essentially live out loud. People use Facebook and Twitter and meetups as ways to connect and talk about issues. So this opportunity to be, to live out loud, to share what you're passionate about, I think is vastly different from previous generations. I think in so many ways we know who philanthropists were from previous generations because of the buildings that we borrow books from and learn in and hear beautiful music played in. So we see their names and understand their legacy in this way. I think what's probably a little bit different is the way that this younger generation signals. And what I mean by that is how we leverage our personal brand for impact. So I'm sitting here talking to you with a pair of Tom's shoes on and ironically looking down and noticing that. And I think in so many ways this younger generation signals in a more subtle way.
And can you explain what signaling is? I'm kind of guessing, but just...
So I think that if I were to... So I live in Washington, D.C. I'm talking to you there, and I can think of how many times I've been in the Mellon Auditorium. And knowing the Mellon Auditorium tells me about who the Mellon family is, what they valued, what they were trying to do when they gave this gift to the nation around art and an opportunity to experience it. What's different? So I think that's a signal. It's a way to express what we're passionate about by building something out of bricks and mortar and kind of put it is very permanent in some ways. I'm wearing a pair of shoes that cost $50 that have this little label on it. I'm not a philanthropist. I work in philanthropy. But it gives me a way to signal to people who look at my shoes, maybe, that I'm more socially conscious as a shoe wearer. It's a smaller scale piece. It's a smaller way, more subtle way of expressing that we are a part of our value system.
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because it, I want to actually talk about the Tom theory or whatever, that, you know, the way the Tom shoes have come out, is that you're really talking about things that are happening outside your backyard. You know, the old philanthropists, at least in the Bay Area, gave us SF MoMA, Chrissy Field, San Francisco Symphony, the Giants.
Restoration of the Palace of Fine Arts.
Yeah, restoration. We could go on and on. Uh-huh. And yet, Mark Zuckerberg, gave from Facebook, the Facebook CEO, his first major charitable donation was giving $100 million to the public schools in New Jersey. Whereas, you know, we have places like Oakland and East Palo Alto that are desperate for money. And so I'm curious, wow, is this new younger generation putting money into bettering the local landscape at all? Maybe, Stephanie, you can talk to that. Or is it all kind of these amazing causes that they value but that won't impact
I think it's both and. I think that the causes do impact us. The investments that Mark Zuckerberg's making in education reform are going to come here in some way, shape, or form, because he's actually, he kind of took right on some of the biggest political and systems change issues in education. And he's giving through other vehicles locally as well. So it's not an only or. But many people tend to, I think that's what I actually found affirming about the Next Gen research, because I have had a lot of thoughts. And as someone who's been in this space for a while and watching many of those iconic givers passing and wondering, you know, who's going to be the next Warren Hellman, who's going to lead our city to the next future, I see, I've been incredibly reaffirmed by the research to show that, you know, even though millennials are coming in sometimes with a more global perspective, they are more geographically dispersed sometimes, but the fact that Mark Zuckerberg gave at home first is actually not surprising to me. That is kind of, we are shaped by our communities where we grow up, and that is, people move away and they will still connect with those communities. At the same time, you know, when they're here, and we have a lot of people who come to the Bay Area, right? And when they're here, I do think we as a community have a huge opportunity that we're not fully maximizing it, in the city in particular, to communicate how we've been shaped by local philanthropy and civic participation and kind of social capital here in the Bay Area, and what it means for you moving forward. Because I do think when they were negotiating the Twitter lease in the city and other things, you know, the government took a step toward what's your commitment to our city, but more about you know, how does this become a community you want to live in for the rest of your life, and what can you contribute from that perspective?
Hold on one second, Danielle. I actually need to just give a station identification. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the rising impact of the young philanthropists, and joining me are Lee Stillwell, Chief Donor Experience and Engagement Officer at the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, Stephanie Furstner-Gillis, the Senior Director of the Foundation Management at Arabella Advisors, and Danielle Orischen-York, Director at 2164. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. We've been talking a little bit about, you know, this new generation of philanthropists and where they're choosing to fund, maybe, and that they're really value-based as opposed to focusing on valuables, and how that might impact the Bay Area. You know, we've talked about how they're definitely giving at home, but hopefully they will be. And it sounds like what Stephanie was saying is they are giving here too. But we want to hear from you. What do you think? Do you think that we as the, or maybe you are giving, but maybe you're not giving, but do you think that we should expect that a certain amount of money from these people should go back to where we live? Or is it really, if it happens, it happens? I'm very curious to hear from you, our listeners. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Danielle, you wanted to say something?
You know, I think I thought that your question that Stephanie was answering about Mark Zuckerberg and this juxtaposition between giving to a school system in Newark, New Jersey, relative to the Bay Area, is really interesting. And I'd be curious to ask Lee, somebody who's working in the philanthropic community at the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, what she sees as the opportunity for nonprofits to engage this younger generation. Because
that's a great question.
This research shows us is that this is a generation that is hungry to participate. Invite us, show us, take us on a tour, help, let us volunteer for you. So I wonder, what is the opportunity or what is the challenge for nonprofits to create that experience of engagement that excites people to give in the Bay Area?
Okay. And Lee, I know you've been kind of chomping at the bit to join us.
Yeah, I know. These are all great questions. So I would say the lesson about Mark and Priscilla's investment in Newark is a case study of investing in an opportunity where there's a confluence of opportunity, high need, and leadership. An inspiring leader in the mayor. So I think that that is what every nonprofit should be thinking about, is how are we telling our story? Do we have the strong web presence that we need to have? And that was certainly clear in the survey. Do we have a great story to tell? And do we have the right leadership?
Okay. Yeah. And is there anything else you want to add in terms of talking?
How nonprofits can certainly get in front of these donors that they want to get in front of. I would say that it's happening. You know, SF MoMA would not be launching into a major expansion campaign if that weren't happening. The Exploratorium would not be reopening. The SF Jazz Center wouldn't be happening. The Bay Lights exhibit wouldn't be on
right now.
Okay,
so this is all from philanthropic money.
Exactly. Okay. And you know, the fact is that many of these donors are still working full-time. And that is a big difference. So much of the work may be slightly under the radar while they need the space and time to continue to focus on both important pursuits.
And, I have to take advantage of just the fact that we were talking about education and we were talking about the things that people are gravitating toward. I do think that, and this is my personal bias here, but I have two kids in public schools in San Francisco. And I do think that is a place where we are not fully leveraging our systems in support of schools. And you see Tom Vander Ark, who used to be at the Gates Foundation, blogging about the irony of us being kind of the home of every tech startup related to ed tech in the country and, all these other things. And, I've always said if I could take donors on tours, when I'm touring parents through the public schools every fall, I would like to include 5 donors on every tour and talk to you about what we could do. Nobody's doing that for the public schools purely fundraising effort.
Let me, we've gotten a couple of emails, and I see that we might have someone on the phone too. So let me just quickly take our first email is from Fran, and she says, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Younger, but still white, right? Could you please talk about how the 2164 Johnson study is mostly about 96% white people? What does this say? Where is the race in all this? Who is defining the future of philanthropy if Latinos and African Americans are not a component in the U.S.? Great question, Fran. Danielle, can you talk to this?
It is a great question, and it's one of the challenges of doing this work with an intensely kind of small group of philanthropists since we're looking at major donors. I think what's particularly challenging, what's particularly illuminating about this question is, the real diverse nature of a younger generation, right? We are today more ethnically diverse as a population of 21 to 40 year olds than we have ever been as a nation. And that idea, growing up with that, I think creates an opportunity for these young leaders that we studied, at least, to be able to engage with differences and diversity more often and in more corners of the world, at more corners of their lives, at least. I'm not sure how to answer the question about, that the person who emailed is asking. However, I think that it's a great one and one that needs to continue to be explored.
I mean, what percentage of your surveyors were, not white, those you surveyed?
I think it's less than 30%. I don't have the numbers sitting right in front of me when I'm talking to you.
All right.
But it is a very small population.
Okay. I would say that there are some exciting stories emerging. Fairly recently, there's a diversity and philanthropy initiative, and there are some really inspiring role models, people of color who are engaged in philanthropy in really meaningful ways that have been tearing it up, so to speak, and trying to tell their stories and make sure that they are part of the picture. But it is definitely a blind spot.
Okay. Let me go to our first caller. We have Bob on the line. Good evening, Bob.
Hi, good evening. My question relates to not one which has been discussed or the thrust of the conversation so far, and that is the Bay Area. But I'm assuming that the people on your panel have antennas in any area of philanthropy. And my question relates to a stereotype, which is that the United States is the main place where philanthropy takes place, and that overseas it's nowhere as near as strong. And I was wondering if there's a new gen growing up in other places of the world, Europe and Asia, where there are very wealthy people who are getting into philanthropy in a much greater extent than in the past.
That's a really great question, Bob. And I would guess I would add on to that. Do people now kind of assume that they should be giving if they make a lot of money? Is it kind of frowned upon, or do they feel kind of like it would be kind of a sin if they didn't give? Lee?
Well, it's certainly one's cultural heritage certainly comes into play. I would say that, you know, over the last 20 years, the proliferation of community foundations, not only in India and throughout Europe, has been quite strong. There are any number of organizations, conferences that pull people from all over the world who are interested in giving. And in that degree, I think the world truly has become quite flat.
And did you have anything else, Bob, to ask? Or did that answer your question?
I think that is very good to hear, and it answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling in. So, Stephanie, would you agree that, I mean, people that you see feel like they have to give, or?
I don't know about have to. I mean, I don't think the social pressure of it is generally what brings people into this work, because it's actually harder, as Carnegie said, it's harder to give the money away sometimes than it is to earn it. I think that, back to my natives versus immigrants kind of analogy, I do think that people's experience with their wealth will affect kind of how they think about that responsibility and the pressure of it. So I think if people have acquired a great deal during their lifetimes and they are immigrants to that experience and they have to kind of integrate their identity as people from what they were to what they are now and kind of navigate that transition, that's harder. And they are in different peer groups and they do feel social pressure and that becomes part of it. But I don't think it's that big.
You know, I ask because Apple has gotten a lot of flack for not being as generous as a lot of other, you know, corporations. And I don't think they've given anything, have they? I mean, I don't, as far as I know. I mean,
as a company? Oh,
as a company.
You know, I always, because we, you know, follow very strong confidentiality policies with our donors, I am always hesitant when I hear that individuals or companies are being criticized for not giving, because the fact is no one actually knows.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I mean, anyway, that is sort of the word on the street, or has been historically. So I didn't, you know, because of that, I wondered if when people see, you know, their friends making millions with IPOs, if they would get the same sort of, you know, looks if they didn't think that they were helping society in some way with their money.
Well, I think what we see, and Stephanie, I would be willing to bet that you agree, that the joy that comes from playing a role in giving and helping to make the world a better place for one person or many people is something, you know, I've never heard a donor complaint or regret
sure, of course.
Getting involved in this work, because yeah. it brings them on more intimate terms with the world. It certainly brings them further along as a person.
Okay.
And often when you're doing giving with the family, it's an incredibly unifying experience.
And especially for those who've acquired it suddenly, and it wasn't, they are immigrants to it. It's especially a connecting point for them with society.
Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the rising impact of the young philanthropists. And joining me are Lee Stillwell, Chief Donor Experience and Engagement Officer at the Silicon Valley Community Foundation, Stephanie Furstner-Gillis, the Senior Director of Foundation Management at Arabella Advisors, and Danielle Oristin-York, the Director at 2164. And we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What do you think charities should do to attract young donors? That was something that was raised by Danielle, and I want to hear from you if you have any ideas. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let me go to another call. We have William from San Francisco. Good evening, William. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to raise a kind of a different issue that I think is relevant, is the sort of explosive growth of donor-advised funds. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of young philanthropists are making gifts with donor-advised funds. And the way those work is that you can make a large gift and take the tax deduction, but there's actually no requirement that you give the money away on any kind of schedule. And with private foundations, you're required to do a payout, you know, 5% a year or whatever it is. And I'm a little concerned about people sort of parking large amounts of money that they aren't required to give away on any kind of schedule.
That's a really good question, William. Thank you for that.
So I'll
Lee?
Take that one.
I think
so,
that's you.
So we manage about 1,000 donor advised funds among the other funds at the Community Foundation. And I can assure you that Silicon Valley Community Foundation works incredibly hard to make sure that we are moving grants out the door. And we have donors that are excited to do that. The last time that I checked, our payout rate was something close to 17%, which far exceeds the 5% requirement of foundations. Last year, we made about $292 million in grants. So the money is flowing quickly, and that is something that we are incredibly happy to see.
I don't think that's...
Stephanie?
At least in my experience, I don't think the donors themselves are thinking about that as the motivation. It's more, there's different advantages and disadvantages to each of the vehicles. But there's also something inspiring to note in that, you know, something like a third of all family foundations have been created since 2000. So, you know, there's been explosive growth in the foundation side as well. It's just a growth net gain.
Uh-huh. Right. That's worked.
And many donors use multiple vehicles.
Exactly.
Which is, you
they
know,
complement.
A terrific scheme.
What are the other vehicles?
So some families might have a private foundation as well as a donor advised fund.
They may have multiple donor advised funds for multiple board members of foundation. Right. They may also have, their personal checkbook that they're giving from.
Okay. Well, I want to bring in Jamie Mayer Finney. She is on the board of her family's large corporation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and their money came from the Sara Lee Corporation. Welcome, Jamie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you are 28, correct?
I am 29.
Oh, 29. Okay. Well,
cusp.
Enjoy your 20s, the last year of your 20s. So do you consider yourself old or young to be managing this kind of money?
You know, for me, first off, age is just a number.
Sure.
We agree.
I grew up with a family foundation. My father was the chair of our family foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, for the majority of my childhood, and the foundation was created posthumously. I was about 2 years old when my great-grandfather passed away, so I can't really remember a time when the foundation didn't exist and a time when I didn't want to be a part of it. So for me, it's really just been growing into my role as a trustee of the board, as opposed to feeling old or feeling young for the part, because it's always been a part of me.
Gotcha. Well, now, the study that was done talks about, you know, people of your generation wanting values more than valuables, leveraging networks, having engagement being very important to them. Do you find, does this resonate with you in terms of how you've been approaching philanthropy?
Oh, absolutely. We, you know, personally, I mean, our generation, we love getting our hands dirty and rolling up our sleeves, and we don't want to be, when organizations approach us, we don't want to be approached for our money, and that's why so many people, I think, are giving anonymously or coming up with names for donor-advised funds or what have you, because we want to be approached for who we are. We want to be approached because we have something to give back for our brains, for our talents, and we want to be involved and be part of a generative board, not just a yes board, and leverage all of the investments that we have. Networking has been mentioned several times on this, and you know that's such a big piece. We want to use our networks, and we want to reach out using our social media, and we really want to be a part of the organizations that we're helping.
How do you navigate family dynamics at the board table? I mean, do you have people that are older that
have
been around for?
Have? Well, you know, we at our foundation, we have independent trustees who are non-family members, and the way that we look at it, the board of our family foundation, it's no different than a board of a nonprofit, right? And the board of a nonprofit, you kind of have slots to fill. You want to have a lawyer, you want to have an accountant, you might want to have a real estate person. And with the family foundation, you look around the table and you see the assets that you have as a family, and then you see areas where you might want to bring in some outside help. And in having independent trustees, we're really held accountable. And it forces us to show up in a way that I like to think as a family we've come really far in the 23 plus years that we've been around as a family foundation. But, you know, we're still a family.
Sure.
And with every family, there are, you know, fun and funky and awkward and quirky and weird dynamics that come into play. And no matter how much we have graduated to a, you know, sophomoric level, in that having other people there and also having a professional staff has really helped us keep ourselves in check and really be there to get the work done.
We have an email from Carl in San Francisco that's I'd like to direct to you, Jamie. He wants to know, and then other people can chime in, of course, but he wants to know, are young donors trying to use technology and social media to leverage their gifts?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes, from the people in the studio. Jamie, do you have any thoughts on that, too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it, you know, there are a lot of different platforms that are out there to do so. The 1% Foundation is a really cool organization that's based out of San Francisco as well, and asks everyone to just give 1% of their paycheck, which is, you know, a really nominal amount, and it creates a network and puts people in community. And part of leveraging investments through your friends and networking online and trying to gain traction that way for things that you care about is you're creating a community around a cause.
There's a lot of crowdsourced philanthropy, too. There's a lot of models and ways for people to make small contributions and work together
and feel like they're part of
networks, as we talk about.
And our research shows that of the top five most important components of the philanthropic strategy as identified by this group of people, the first and most important one is conducting due diligence and doing research before deciding whom I'm going to support. To do that, 91% of the respondents of this survey say that they search for information using an organization's website, being able to understand what it is that they're looking at in a very quick, palatable kind of way is very important.
Do you find that you're generally proactive about where you place your money, or that you are more reactive in terms of people that approach you?
Incredibly, incredibly proactive. I personally tend to plan my giving out about 2 to 3 years in advance, with some reserves put aside for, of course, you know, natural disasters and things that come up that you can't really predict. And I think as a generation, we're much less siloed in our giving. It's not like we have a certain amount we give to the arts and a certain amount that we give to the environment and a certain amount that we might give to religious organizations, but more really looking at the world in a holistic way and seeing how we can create systemic change and what that looks like as a, you know, kind of grand 5, 10, 15 year plan, and trying to make traction in that as opposed to just looking at, you know, smaller grants, or even if they're larger grants, just direct service grants that may have a huge impact now, or band-aid an issue or bypass a problem, but not necessarily create real change down the road.
I see. Did you have, now, one of the results from the survey talked about where people who inherited money versus, you know, made all their own money came, like they had different ideas about who their role models were. I bet your family, as you said, was part of your role models, but were there other people out there that served as role models?
Absolutely. The thing about, you know, a family foundation, it's not that different from having a family business. You're always going to be the kid if you are of a generation below the people above you. It doesn't matter how old you are. My 91-year-old grandmother, who's amazing, thinks that my 70-year-old cousin is a kid because he's the generation below her. So I really found in my foundation, it was the staff members of the foundation who took me under their wings and really treated me like an adult before anyone in the family could see me as an adult. I'm an artist, and this one program director, Claudine Brown, took me to affinity group meetings to grant makers in the arts, and I went to Council on Foundations, and I became chair. I'm currently chair of the Council on Foundations Film Festival, and I got to grow up and learn about the world of philanthropy totally separate from my family, learning and being valued for who I am and what I had to bring to the table. And yes, of course, I'm not dumb. I wouldn't have been there if it weren't for the fact that I had my family foundation's name on my name tag. But I got to make a name for myself and find my own place by being brought under this amazing woman's wing, and taken around to meet people and create my own relationships.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jamie. Let me, please stay on the line. I want to take another caller. We have George. Welcome, George. Thank you for calling City Visions.
Thank you. Listening, we thought there's an implied question that might be stated, too, in as much as your program was launched on the concept of a new generation of grant.
The donors?
Funders, donors coming along in the grant writing process, as well as a new generation of grantors, there's a new generation of grantees. Mm-hmm. And possibly there's a broker in the middle to help people meet each other, but there's still this question that people are going to have about, well, how do I become engaged in this process? How does one learn about this? There's probably not a school or even a course in grant writing until you get pretty far along in your education, if then. So what pointers can people give to the next generation of recipients?
Where do you come from? Are you just curious, or are you involved in a nonprofit, or do you have a something that you would love to get money for?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say, I think more of a busybody than you could say.
Fair enough.
I'd like to see how this process. You see, here's one thing. People frequently say, and when they're talking about going and applying for money to a foundation or other prospective supporter, well, this is a good thing, but we don't want to encumber ourselves with a lot of strings, and money always comes with strings. Well, that may or may not be true, but if people stand back and wait for somebody to work this out, it's a pretty sure thing that the people who have grants to give are going to give them to somebody.
Someone, yeah. George,
and
great,
if
great
want
point.
To evolve the situation, you really have to think about it, both sides.
Mm-hmm. Let me throw your question to Stephanie, and she can give us some insight.
Well,
Well, I think what I was thinking as you were speaking was that, you know, grant writing actually is to some extent generational. I mean, it's still a really important critical component of the process. But what we saw in this research is how important relationships will always be, and kind of peer influences as well as family influences and others. And I think those who want to, we definitely are building a pipeline of young nonprofit leaders, and some of the best ways to get engaged are actually through some of the activities and events and other things that the nonprofits are doing to engage these young people who want to be involved in social change work. And so they have no sense right now if they are going to be next gen philanthropists or if they're going to be the next leader of the nonprofit. But they know that these people are deeply committed, have a lot of passion, have great kind of commitment to the work. And so there are ways for people to get exposed to the work itself and how the fundraising process happens and participate. And there are lots of ways also for obviously young philanthropists to get training. And we're in this wonderful position where we get to provide capacity building support and orientation and help people get familiar with the landscape.
Well, we're coming. Oh.
Lauren,
yes, please,
Stephanie's comments. Oh. I think one of the things that I would offer in the response to George's question for anybody who's interested in philanthropy is that I think to look to your own community, to look at your own community's foundation, to go and ask and say, I'm curious, I want to learn, no matter what side of the table you're on, is a really great starting point because you live and experience the community in where you're located. So that's a great starting point. Firms like Arabella are wonderful. At 2164, we run peer networks of young funders so they can learn from each other. We create experiences for people to learn about issues in very tactile, practical, fun, engaging ways. And there are also great organizations like EPIP, the Emerging Practitioners in Philanthropy, which are gatherings of young people who are leaders in the nonprofit sector as well as young funders.
I'm going to stop you, Danielle, because we are coming to the top of the hour, and I want to throw a question out. It's an email. It's going to be the last email of the night. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time, but maybe if you just guys have just a couple of sentences you can use to answer this question. This is from Bryn. And she says, while there have been great advances and investments made in monitoring and evaluation, what does the panel think is the most important tool for the nonprofit community that the nonprofit community has to demonstrate how the next generation can affect true change with large and lasting impact? Stephanie, you want to? I know. I do have
Stephanie,
I know.
You take that one.
Or maybe Stephanie, do you want to answer this? Do you have some thoughts, Julie? Okay, so I'll let Stephanie and Lee take this.
I mean, I'm going to hook on the first part of that comment, which is that there has been so much opening up and increased transparency in our sector and the ability to have data and understand how change is happening and what change is happening, people sharing their information. So
I just got word. I am so sorry, but I just got word that we are at the top. It's the end of the show. So I hate to cut you off, and this is such an important question, but thank you all so much for coming on this show. This has been City Visions. My guests, Lee Stillwell, Stephanie Furstner-Gillis, and Daniel Orischen York. Thank you so much. And Jamie Mayer Finney, thank you so much for joining me this evening. I want to thank our guests and also our engineer, Eric Wayne, our producer, Wendy Holcomb. Thank you so much, Wendy. Fantastic show. And Susie Britton is our senior producer. On a personal note, I just want to say that this year marks my 10th year here at City Visions, and on this milestone, I'm going to be leaving and passing the baton to a new host. So tonight is my last night. So I want to thank everyone who I've been able to work with, including Rose Levinson, our founder. And best to you. Good evening, and have a great week.